Buddhist Summer School, Tuesday, 31st August, 1982. Venerable sirs, venerable lady, it was mentioned in the talk on Sunday that our mode of awareness of existence, because of the influence of separate sense functions and the activity of the brain, is an analytic, discriminative mode. So, we are aware in terms of duality and multiplicity. Hence, we cannot communicate with each other except in terms of duality and multiplicity. In terms of separateness, therefore, and isolatedness, and in terms of otherness, measurability, finitude, temporality, and mortality. Thus arise comparison, preferential choice, bias, prejudice, and the whole host of troublesome things and situations. The whole of dukkha, in short. But by very virtue of duality, we can, by means of speech, contradict one dual. This could lead to absurdity. If you have a phrase like, the son of a barren woman, it could lead to confusion when we learn at school that A plus B, A and B representing particular quantities, are always equal to B plus A, and then usually in the second year at university the lecturer says, today we'll try and demonstrate that A plus B is not always equal to B plus A under certain conditions. It comes as a tremendous shock. It could lead also to consternation. When we first hear, nirvana is samsara and samsara is nirvana. But in certain cases, it could release perfect harmony if the contradiction does not destroy the dual. In fact, the dualism of speech, rightly worked upon, leads to a transformation of our mode of awareness. Analysis, separation, unrelatedness, all change into an integrated unity. Conflict and confusion into peace and enlightenment. Vijnana, our discriminative consciousness, flowers out into Vijnanam Anidassanam Anantam Sabbato Pabam, which means consciousness characterless, endless, and therefore beginningless, everywhere shining. The Majjhima uses the word Pabam. The Digha Nikaya has the same phrase. This is spoken by the Buddha himself. It has pahang, which means accessible, everywhere accessible. What has happened is that you have emerged out of the imprisoning context of the finite, temporal and mortal into the freedom of the infinite, eternal and immortal, which is the context of and is identical with transcendence itself. Beware of making a serious mistake here. The infinite, eternal, immortal is not the opposite of, but actually the source of the finite, temporal and mortal, which is wholly subsumed in, that is, not merely contained in, like an orange in a box. Both orange and box are finite and separate, despite the containment, but completely suffused by, interpenetrated by, and with transcendence. How does this happen? How does the unitary whole become the multitudinous many? By self-constriction. We may put it this way, the very ancient teachers in India and those who were responsible for the Kabbalah have put it this way, desiring the absolute, desiring to see its own face, to use human limited language, emits and projects its own container out of its own eternal being. The container, of course, is the manifested universe. That is, primordial, undifferentiated creative energy, self-existent and self-replenishing, which is also absolute pure consciousness, spins the universal web of becoming out of its own substance. I have to use the word substance, but I'm using it essentially in the meaning of that which underlies, substance, which stands under, standing under. Have you watched a spider at work? Out of its own substance, it spins out its web. Everyone and everything constitutes that web and is held in a single, unbreakable unity, although each conscious being or creation can misbehave and sway the web, causing strain, terror, and sorrow. Do what we will or can, the one total reality can never be diminished or annihilated. Nor will the cosmos, as cosmos, react against us. We may be tossed about in the cosmos, but the cosmos will never throw us out. Where indeed can we be thrown out? We are in the cosmos, we can be pushed about, but we can't be thrown out of the cosmos. In the ultimate, we can neither be punished in the eternal sense, like the eternal heaven hell idea, you see, or rewarded. We can be healed, but our healing is our own responsibility. We have to live in such manner that the healing power of transcendence can work freely, unopposed by us. If we begin to get a glimmering of this, we shall see clearly the immeasurable significance and power of the teaching in the great religions, especially emphasized in the Upanishads and the Buddha's teachings and in yoga, and in our own day and age by Krishnamurti, the teaching that we should free ourselves of all, mind you, without any exception, all attachment and aversion. These two are characteristic of our functioning in terms of vijnana, discriminating this and that, separating them out. The divisive agent in us. And yet, this self-same divisive agent, when worked upon by samasati, perfect mindfulness, and by right contemplation, which really is that aspect of mindfulness which enables panya, insight, unerring insight, to become operative. When that takes place, this vijnana is transmuted into vijnanam anidasanam anantam sabbato bhavam. Consciousness which is characterless, remember that, pure absolute consciousness, it's characterless, endless, beginningless, therefore, also, everywhere shining. What happens is that my or your vijnana vanishes. Vijnana, in its restricted aspect as discriminative consciousness, is personal to the particular existential being. The absolute consciousness, which is completely free of the separative subject-object relationship and functioning, supervenes. The pure mind, the Buddha mind, functions freely in both ways when that happens, in the limited and personal, as well as the cosmic and transpersonal, through the individual who has realized perfect enlightenment. It is realized through this mortal person, let us call him A, B, as long as the organism lives. On the death of the organism, transcendence alone is. Let me digress for a moment. In the Katha Upanishad, we have a very remarkable teaching. The Brahman Vajashravas is giving away all his possessions before he makes the supreme sacrifice. And his son, Nachiketas, and the name Nachiketas means the unknowing one, asks his father, "To whom will you give me, father?" And the father doesn't reply at once. On the third asking, the father says, "To death, to Yama, Yamaraja, I give you." So the son, being the son of a Brahman, dutifully proceeds to the house of death. But the lord of death, Yamaraj himself, is absent. And he's absent for 3 days. Very interesting, this period of 3 days and nights. And when Yamaraja comes and finds a Brahman waiting for him, he is very apologetic indeed and says to Nachiketas, "Ask any 3 boons and they will be granted to you. The first boon is, may my father's annoyance be appeased." And then he asks the boon about yoga and the sacred fire and how to build it and so on. But the third boon which he asks is this. This doubt there is in regard to a man deceased. He exists, say some. He exists not, say others. This would I know, instructed by thee. The Lord of Death says, "Ask any other boon, but don't ask me this. This has been asked by gods and sages, and I cannot answer it." Which is not true, actually. The Lord of Death can answer it. And the Lord of Death offers Nachiketas all the goods of the earth and enjoyments and pleasures and power and kingdoms and whatnot. And Nachiketas says to him, he stands unswerving and says, "There is none like thee, O Death, who can answer. Keep all your pleasures and your dancing and your treasures and whatnot. I don't want them. This is the only thing I want from you, the answer to this. All the offered wealth, be it of earth or dignities, of pleasures or intellects or skills, cannot compare with the pearl beyond price. The answer to this question," and this, as we all know, was the fundamental problem which the Buddha tackled himself. Now, what is the meaning of this sort of story? death gives the answer, you see, and the end of it all is that Nachiketas, the unknowing one, realizes Brahman, the supreme reality, and becomes free from passion, free from death. What does this mean? Going to the home of the Lord of Death and to be taught by the Lord of Death. I've written here in The Heart of Religion, in the silent aloneness of the supreme communion, there is the cessation of all discriminative consciousness. All speech and thought, all particular and limited mental activity is in repose, and there is a suspension of the mortal mode of consciousness. What I mean by that is, you know, we are conscious, something uprises in mind, and we are conscious of that. It proceeds and it comes to the end. That is our mortal mode of consciousness. Everything is known by us, and we are conscious of everything in that way, the mortal way. It begins, proceeds, dies. Now, going to the home of death, as I said, the silent aloneness of the supreme communion, in this enstasy, which is neither a trance nor a state of ecstasy — enstasy and ecstasy are quite different. Ecstasy is being beside yourself, outside yourself. When you are perfectly poised, perfectly calm, utterly pure, then is the real looking within and discovering thou art Buddha. You see? That is the meaning of enstasy. In this enstasy, the Holy One has died to the known world. He has entered the house of death. He is actually alive, because he is in that profound meditative state. Alive, he knows death. He himself is now the Lord of the death. Then there is manifest on earth the realization of the immeasurable unknown, the unborn, undying, fearless, sorrowless Atma. That's how Atma is spoken of in the pre-Buddhistic Upanishads. Afterwards, the teaching given by the Holy One when he emerges out of that meditative state back into the ordinary state is the fruit of this communion known as the dialogue with death. I don't know whether anyone, any scholar or anyone has offered that sort of explanation of what the Katha Upanishad is about. Now, we go on. On the death of the organism, transcendence alone is. So the death, that is the ultimate parinibbana, on the death of the organism. A.B., the person, as an identifiable entity, is no more, absolutely no more. All that constituted the entity, the psychophysical being, is once again the one total reality, infinite, eternal, immortal. If we see this, we shall see that with respect to each one of us, I, the existential being, the mortal nama-rupa, I am the inheritor of the totality. And as such, this mortal nama-rupa, characterized by anicca, dukkha, anatta, is fully interpenetrated by the whole of infinity, by all eternity. You see, this is one of the greatest errors, I think, that all the theologies of the world have made. they have failed to recognize that we as we are capable of reducing our total awareness into to two contexts, the finite temporal mortal and the infinite eternal immortal. But we don't, we haven't even begun to understand the relationship between these two. I put it in these terms, that the infinite eternal immortal completely subsumes and interpenetrates and interacts with the finite temporal and mortal. And in the supreme meditative state, this absolute oneness, this unitary wholeness is realized, actually consciously realized. You notice one of the very interesting points that the Buddha makes. He always says that you are conscious, you are clearly conscious as you enter the deep states. Now this is contradictory. This is something which the Christian mystics denied. They said it is granted to you by grace from the wholly other transcendent, only for a flash, for a few moments, and no more. The Buddha said you can enter into it as you wish, when you wish, as long as you wish. Of course, the as long as you wish has its limitation, because the body has to get out of that state to continue to live. And the Buddha says, when he talks to the Jains, he says, for 7 days and seven nights I can remain in this state. So you see, we have a little disagreement between Christian mysticism and the Buddhist meditation and so forth. Now, if we can, at least we can begin with an intellectual grasp of the fact that the whole of infinity and all eternity, it completely interpenetrates the finite mortal, the finite temporal mortal state in which we are all the time. So that to say my immortal soul or my Atma is a tremendous mistake. The later Upanishads unfortunately made this mistake, and they talked of the Atma as seated in the heart without defining precisely what they meant by Hridaya in that context. And they said the Atma the size of a thumb. Sometimes they, and of course in the Chandogya I think, smaller than the smallest grain of millet, larger than the largest thing that you know, you see, and so forth. You know, once you introduce the criteria and the system of measurement of the finite, temporal, and mortal, and apply it to the infinite, eternal, and immortal, you are in a nice old mess. You just make a muddle of the whole thing. I believe Krishnamurti has understood this so well that he has just swept aside all the theologies of the world and so forth. He has nothing to do with them. We may say that transcendence of its own free will and accord has submitted to its imprisonment in each and every particular composing the manifested universe. We never liberate our mortal selves. By living the religious life in perfection, we transmute the entire prison house of transcendence, that is, the each of us as an existential being, and transcendence is again pure, holy transcendence, absolute, the Holy Spirit, as one may say. And the supreme purpose of our individual existence as existential beings is divinely fulfilled. This is, to me, the supreme purpose of the existence of human beings on the earth. Look at the word existence, from the Latin ex, out of, sistere, to stand out of. And in the Visuddhimagga, in Nyanamoli's translation, I think it's on page 563, he speaks of dukkha this way, du, meaning that which is spoiled or bad. Duppati, it's the prefix to the verb duppati, do bad, made bad, and kham is the same as the Sanskrit kham, which means the infinite. You see, if you talk of the infinite, you can also use the word eternal in the same context. They are an identity. The infinite, the eternal, the immortal are all an identity. Just as if you say Albert John Jones, three words, they are not three different people. They are the same person. And whether you call him Albert or John or Jones, he will say, yes, what can I do for you? You see, it's like that. Now, if we understand that, we can sort of begin to get that sense of transcendence by which the intellect can perhaps begin to understand what to discard when attempting to pierce into the transcendence. You know the famous neti neti of Yajnavalkya. Not this, not this. Whatever descriptive terms you use, that's not transcendence, because it is nondescript altogether. But the purpose of our existence is fulfilled when we effect this liberation of transcendence out of its prison house, which is ourselves, by our complete purification, by our realizing Samma Sambodhi. And this is one of the supreme things that the Buddha did in a very extraordinary way, and he made it open. He was in reality the culmination of the Vedic Upanishadic teaching. He was the culmination of it. Not culmination, not in the sense of superiority, but in the sense of making everything, opening the doors of heaven to each and everybody. You see? And it's interesting. The doors of deathlessness are open. Those are his own words to Brahma Sahampati. We in the world who are still subhumans, I'm not using sub pejoratively, never need to form a PLO, a People's Liberation Organization. But we do need to be completely committed to a TLO, a Transcendence Liberation Organization, for which we must completely sacrifice all separate, isolative and isolating selfhood. The sacrifice must be absolutely complete. This was the original meaning of the Purushamedha, the sacrifice of the man. The Druids, I believe, in Britain, sacrificed living human beings. And of course, in amongst primitive peoples, that sacrifice was there. But in ancient India, people understood that the Purushamedha, you see, the complete sacrifice of the man was the sacrifice of selfhood, of separative, isolative selfhood, which made the self and the not-self operative. And that meant a perpetual conflict, the self wanting to get whatever it wanted out of the total not-self. Then there is the realization of Vijnanam Anidasanam Anantam Sabbado Papam. Those words really sound like magic to me, which the Upanishads termed the realization of the Atma. When the Buddha uses phrases like self upbraids the self, atta pi attanam upavadati, or make the self your refuge and your lamp, atta deepa viharatha atta sarana. Atta, in that context, is used in the sense of Atma of the pre-Buddhistic Upanishads. So too, when he says to the young men picnicking on the road from Benares to Uruvela, what think ye Were it not better he sought for the self, atanam gavesa yatha, rather than the woman? You know the story, when he was beginning his ministry, a crowd of young men with their wives, and one chap who was unmarried with his mistress, they all came in to enjoy themselves in the woodland, and the mistress went off with some of the goods of these people. And so they started searching for the woman, and they met the Buddha and asked him, did you see this woman, and etc. And he says, he just told them, what do you think? Is it better to seek that woman or to seek the Atma, the Atta? We can see from all the above that the common worldwide belief, I am the doer, is a misconception, because the word I is used in the sense of an identifiable, unchanging, fixed entity. The identification by each person is with his body, an identification which begins from birth and persists throughout life for the vast majority of people. Because of this identification, man's primary interest is his own body. People like ourselves who seek the Atta, seek the self, if you like, you see. People like ourselves, after all, if we examine ourselves very, very carefully, a merciless scrutiny, we will find that very largely we identify ourselves with the body. No getting away from that fact. Because of this identification, man's primary interest is his own body. Genuine altruistic and philanthropic aspirations and activities characterize an insignificant minority of the world population. And of this minority, there is only a very small proportion truly concerned with the religious life and earnestly living it actually. We haven't gone forth. When you find those who have gone forth and are in the Sangha as such, then you have the serious workers. Religious living grows out of the pure seed of utter selflessness, and the selflessness has to be absolute. It's so difficult, by no means easy. People say, oh, but how can this apply to us ordinary folk in the world? Well, it does not apply to us ordinary folk in the world. And also it does apply if we are interested and we care. The trouble is we don't care. The way to care is beautifully expressed in the Upanishads in that word tadvanam, which stands for an absolutely burning, utterly consuming all dross, a burning love for truth. That is the tadvanam. He who has clearly seen that there is nothing whatsoever for himself, for me, the me that is the perishing mortal being, he truly can live religiously, for he alone can be the clean vessel, the holy temple of transcendence. The identification by each person with his body has been roundly condemned by the great religions of the world, except Zarathustrianism, and especially so by Hinduism and Buddhism. They have condemned the body. In order to be free of attachment to the body, the meditation on the foulness of the body, its ill states, aging, decay, and death were prescribed in Buddhist discipline. If you study the Maitri Upanishad and the Garbha Upanishad, you will find a good deal of this condemnation of the body on the because of its foulness, as they call it. In order to be free of attachment to the body, the meditation on the foulness of the body, its ill states, aging, decay and death were prescribed in Buddhist discipline. But all the components listed as foul, blood, phlegm, mucus, urine, feces, etc., etc., are all essential components of the living body. They serve their own special functions in the living process. That which is foul from the body's point of view, all that we eliminate, is used by the soil to become fertile, and plants can grow and so forth. We must remember that there is this extraordinary interplay of everything on the planet Earth. And if one really sees it in its wholeness and accepts it with real understanding and love, you will find yourself enjoying existence on this planet in the most remarkable way. Deep, profound, peaceful, and reverential. Insofar as one lives like a sensible human being, all that is called foul, as well as all that is fair, maintains an ecological balance. In trying to free oneself from the bondage of attachment by cultivating disgust for the body, is it wise to enter the prison of aversion for the processes of nature and allow self-hate to work its ravages upon our organic well-being? Self-hate inevitably leads to hate and violence and cruelty to others. People who are cruel to others, the extent of their cruelty is very considerably a measure of their own self-hate. Undoubtedly, we must see the foulness aspect. We must see clearly whatever is. But even more undoubtedly, we must see the fair aspect also. See the marvel and wonder of the body and learn the deep lessons the body can teach us if we have the humility and decency to observe comprehensively and learn joyfully. I often wonder whether, after all, the body is not one of our greatest teachers in the art of living. If you really understand the body, and that means one really should study modern physiology and anatomy. The old people knew a great deal of about anatomy and so forth. They knew some physiology, but they didn't know anything like what we know today. What we know today, if we really appreciate it and understand it, will make us reverence the body. And indeed, both Hinduism and Buddhism have expressed right appraisal of the living body. The Skanda and Maitreya Upanishads have affirmed categorically, the body is said to be the temple. The dweller in the temple is Shiva, not an ego I. Shiva, the third person of the Holy Trinity, the creator of the universe and the reabsorber of the universe. The Buddhist teaching states, it is hard to obtain human birth. It is only a human, not any other type of being, who can realize Samma Sambodhi. Not the devas, not the gods, and certainly not the devils, can realize Samma Sambodhi. Only a human being can do it. Can realize that and enable the beatitude of nirvana to be manifest through him. St. Paul writes in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, verse 16, "Know ye not that ye are the temple of God, and the Spirit of God dwelleth in you?" And in 2 Corinthians 6, 16, he says, "For ye are the temple of the living God." He uses the same idea, the temple of the living God, just as the Skanda and Maitreya Upanishad says. Body is the temple. Attachment or aversion for the body leads to numerous ills. Free of attachment and aversion, we must understand the body and regard it with reverence. The body, the psychophysical organism, Nama Rupa, is a microcosm, the mortal, finite representative of the immortal and infinite transcendence. All too few mortals see and appreciate the significance and implications of being a microcosm. If only we could see this and live in accordance with such vision, we would awake to the fact that we are essentially transcendence embodied. That is what we actually are. This existential being with all his defects, his drawbacks, his ignorance, and so forth, is actually, as far as he as a living existent is concerned, he is transcendence embodied. Our divine potential is transcendence, the total reality. And if our living process perfectly expresses that potential, this world would be peopled by perfected holy ones. The Buddha positively affirmed transcendence. As you know, in the Udana you find it, monks, there is an unborn, unbecome, unmade, etc., etc. And if you turn over the page where that occurs for the first time, he declared, hard is the infinite to see. Truth is no easy thing to see. See, when I use this phraseology, infinite, eternal, immortal, I'm not manufacturing this and sort of palming it off on people. It is the old teaching, actually. Lastly, in connection with the body, note what the Buddha says about mindfulness centered on the body. It comes in the first volume of the Anguttara Nikaya, pages 39 to 41. I've got the first volume down there if anybody likes to look at it afterwards. He says, one thing, if practiced and made much of, conduces to great thrill. I think that's marvelous. Conduces to great thrill. I don't know whether he says that in any other context, whether it comes anywhere in the Pali canon. I don't know the whole of the Pali canon. Does anyone know whether that word thrill occurs somewhere? One thing is, if practiced and made much of, conduces to great thrill, profit, security, knowledge, insight, release, calm of body and mind, fullness of all good things, arhantship, the establishment of the deathless. And it's a tremendously strong thing to say. What is that one thing? It is mindfulness centered on the body. This thing of foulness. Centered on the body. Mindfulness centered on the body. Because the deathless has been realized by those who have realized mindfulness centered on the body. And in the second volume of the Anguttara, page 57, is that wonderful pithy declaration. In this very fathom-long body, along with its perceptions and thoughts, I proclaim, is all the world and the origin of the world, and the making of the world to end. Likewise, the practice going to the ending of the world. If I were to put it in my own terms, the world is the existential finite, temporal, mortal. The ending of the finite, temporal, mortal, you see, does not mean annihilation at all. It certainly means the complete transmuting of this into the infinite, eternal, and immortal. This idea, of course, we all know that the body dies. All the holy ones died. They were born like anybody else, not through parthenogenesis, believe me. The good old story of the Virgin, of the Immaculate Conception and the virgin birth, has a very profound meaning for the mystic who undergoes that in his own inner consciousness as he enters deeper and deeper states of meditation. So it is not through parthenogenesis at all. So it is a case of making an ending of mortality. And the Buddha also shows transfiguration. His whole being is transfigured, and you have the whole you have the presentation of transfiguration in the case of Jesus Christ also. This transfiguration comes also in Zarathustrianism. I don't know whether it is associated with Sri Krishna. I don't think so. I don't think in the Gita the transfiguration is there. Perhaps when Krishna gives the revelation, reveals, when Arjuna asks him, reveal. Yes, yes. You see, and Arjuna sees the transfigured Krishna. Now, this is rather wonderful. The transfiguration in the case of the Buddha and of Jesus Christ is one which just shines with glory. The whole body is sort of golden and shining and so forth. You see, there's a peculiar emanation of light from the body. But Krishna expresses the totality. There is nothing excluded. He even says, I am the gambling of the cheat and the splendor of splendid things am I. So you see, that is an extreme, that is, I think, the most inclusive presentation of reality, of truth, as represented by transfiguration. You find it in the Gita. What chapter is it exactly? 11, yes. It starts in the 11th and goes on, yes.
10th and 11th together.
Mm, yes, it's a wonderful presentation. So is the world and the practice of going to the end of the world. How are we for time? Oh yes, I think we have a few minutes. Whilst we are talking of the body, I should just like to draw your attention to something like this, to this. In the Atharva Veda, in the 10th and 11th books, there are two very remarkable hymns. In these hymns, the question is asked, who made this body? The head, the skull, the eyes, the neck, the arms, and so on, enumerating the body. Remember, the Atharva Veda is at least 1000 BC, as far back as 1000 BC, at least that, maybe older even. And the answer given by the Holy One who wrote those hymns is that such and such a god, Deva, made this, and having made it, he entered into it. Now this is the significant point. Such and such a Deva, or if you like to translate it as a god, made this part of the body and entered into it. And so on, the whole body is described. And so in verse 18, yes, this is the 8th hymn of book 11. In verse 18, you get the sentence, God's made the mortal their abode and entered and possessed man. All these gods and devas and the archangels and angels and so forth, they all represent archetypal cosmic expressions of the primordial creative energy. That is the meaning of these personifications. The meaning of Michael, for instance, Michael, is he who is like God. You see? Raphael, he who is the healer. And it's in Arabic and in Gujarati, I'm not sure about Arabic, but I think in Arabic too, and in Gujarati, Rafu means to heal a wound. You see, Raphael is that cosmic energy which is which is the healer. Gods made the mortal their abode and entered and possessed the man. Then sleep, sin, old age, prosperity, knowledge, ignorance, in short, everything constituting man and his life, entered into the body. So did all the great gods. Varuna, the moral governor of the universe. Indra, who represents the peak point of individuality as such. Indra is very much misinterpreted by, has been very much misinterpreted by Western scholars. He represents the peak point of individuality. Soma represents inspiration. It has nothing to do with a drink which is brewed. Believe me, if only scholars would study the Rig Veda carefully, they will find it clearly stated in one of the hymns. I won't waste time getting the reference here. The soma which we Brahmins know is not a drink. It is not known by mortals. It is not drunk. It is that which makes one immortal. But they say, they put it in symbolical language, say, we have drunk soma and become immortal. Has anybody drunk vodka or whiskey and become immortal? You see, one has to go very deeply into these things. And verse 32, which is, I think, the last word, last verse in that hymn. Therefore, whoever knoweth man regardeth him as Brahman's self. The one absolute manifests itself as innumerable millions of existential beings who are his self on earth. This is a wonderful conception, wonderful presentation, and I believe it is literally true insofar as time and space will allow us human beings to realize our fruition, our full fruition. The body is in fact transcendence embodied. This is what I have written about it. The timeless beyond expresses me, expresses me through star-encircled solitudes to incarnate here. The beyond, the solitude, the incarnation, and the answer are the transcendent here now, the immediate moment, the absolutely immediate moment, the measureless point which is the temple, the body. Look at this body with the third eye. This is your vision in communion, samadhi. You will see why the Buddha talks about centered upon the body, mindfulness centered upon the body, establishes deathlessness. You will see the Dharmakaya, the body of law, of eternal order. Experience this body through purified and perfected senses, free of all grasping. This is your pratyahara, your withdrawal from all, your freedom from all attachment and aversion. You will enjoy the sambhogakaya then, the body of bliss, if you are utterly free of all aversion and attachment. Invoke this body to work upon, and by means of your body. You see, the first word body is in capitals to represent the total, the divine body, so to say. This is the work of the Savior. Buddhism and Christianity are both definitely religions of salvation. So we could just as well call the Buddha a Savior as the Lord of compassion and wisdom. The Savior, the teacher, the instrument of salvation transforming the world. You will make manifest the Nirmanakaya, the body of transformation. The Buddha declared, it comes in several contexts actually through the Majjhima Nikaya. The person who is neither a self-tormentor nor intent on the practice of self-torment, nor a tormentor of others, not intent on the practice of tormenting others, he, neither a self-tormentor nor a tormentor of others, is here now allayed, quenched, become cool, an experiencer of bliss, and he lives with a self Brahman become. That is a tremendous statement to make. Note how often the Buddha actually uses Upanishadic terms. You see? This is a weighty declaration. A careful study of the whole discourse would amply repay the student. It comes in the Majjhima, the first volume, pages 348 and 49. That is only one context. There are several such contexts. Now, I think conventional Buddhism has forgotten how close the Buddha was to the Upanishadic period. It was just within 100 years only of the golden age of the Upanishads, when the greatest of the teachers flourished, that the Buddha was born. And whilst their teaching was somewhat restricted in compass to the select few, that is, it's not that they selected the few, but those who came to them of their own free will and accord were only a few after all, not too many. Now look, here in the first, in the second volume of the Majjhima, in the Kita Giri Sutta, he says, as to this, because one who has faith draws close. Drawing close, he sits down nearby. Sitting down nearby, he lends ear. Lending ear, he hears Dhamma. Having heard Dhamma, he remembers it. He tests the meaning of the things he has borne in mind. While testing the meaning, the things are approved of. There being approval of the things, desire is born. But the word used there is kusala chanda. Now you see, this is not desire in our ordinary sense, I wish this, I want that, I'd like this, let's have a good time, or any such nonsense. This desire is that burning passion now for the realization of the Supreme, This is the desire that is born. With desire born, he makes an effort. Having made the effort, he weighs it up. Having weighed it up, he strives. Being self-resolute, he realizes with his person. He realizes with his person the highest truth itself, and penetrating it by means of wisdom, he sees. Now, the point is this. These stages which he talks of, he draws close, he sits down, he lends ear, he hears them. This precisely is the meaning of the word Upanishad. Going to the one who is the teacher, drawing close, sitting down and listening. Then when he talks of, when the Buddha says, of the listening, lends ear. You know how often the Buddha says, bhikkhus? And they say, yes, revered sir. You see? I shall speak about Dhamma. And of course the bhikkhus say, jolly good, do so. the Buddha says, listen carefully and I will speak. Listen carefully and I will speak. Now, in the Upanishadic teachings, we have the three stages mentioned. The Shravana, the hearing, the Manana, the contemplating it, and the Nididhyasana, the deep meditation, which brings about real insight. And what does the Buddha say? He weighs it up. Having weighed it up, he strives. He realizes with his person the highest truth. And penetrating it by means of wisdom, he sees. See, the Buddha was really the son and heir of the Upanishadic life and teaching. It's extraordinary. I mean, there are so many correspondences which I've seen. After all, I've studied these texts, the actual texts, for, 1939-40 onwards. So that I have learned a little bit. And the correspondences with the Upanishadic teachings is simply remarkable. And so many of the Buddha's phrases, well, perhaps not so many, but a good few of the Buddha's phrases were said by Jesus afterwards in his ministry. It's a very extraordinary thing. So, having said that, let's go on with this in connection with the body. How easily I say my body. Some scriptures tell me it is vile, a thing of sin and corruption, of bondage and temptation and misery, doomed to die. That is quite true. Those same scriptures also tell me of my great good fortune in obtaining human birth, for it is only through the human state that the realization of transcendence is possible. That the body is a temple of the... Well, I have already quoted that, which is also quite true. My body is a statement of fiction, of empirical convenience. I have no exclusive proprietorship over the body. Consider, my breath comes in and goes out speedily. Food and drink likewise, more slowly. The cells of the body undergo constant change. What shall I hold and say, this is mine or me? This body, a living pattern, apparent to sense perception, is entirely dependent for its existence upon you and everything that is not this body. You know, this is something which we should really meditate upon deeply. If we can successfully meditate upon this tragic divorce which we have established, self, not self, will disappear. And with it, so much misery and fear, anxiety, grief, everything will disappear. I assure you, that is so. Self exists by virtue of not self. Why? You mentioned it yesterday in your talk, didn't you, Philip? This relationship with the not. If there was nothing outside this self, how could this self subsist at all? Solid, liquid, gaseous things, fire, air, earth, water, everything, the outside is in interaction with us. Every single human being, every single creature, every virus, every mosquito, every perfected holy one, every god, every devil is constantly in interaction with us all the time. And if we can really awake to the at-one-ment, this is the real atonement. If we can awake to the at-one-ment, then all the good and all the evil of the world flows freely into our psyche. And if we have discipline, if we discipline ourselves properly, we can transmute the ill in which enters our own psyche, because the psychical atmosphere constantly affects us day and night. You see, you would transmute that psychical atmosphere and one becomes a benediction to the world thereby. It's very important to realize this. Not for a moment could there be my body or self if it were not for you and the world body, the not self. Let me understand this with all my heart, not merely my head. It starts with the head. It has a thought, an intellectual perception, a sanya. Free of the illusions born of isolated self-consciousness, the delusion-generating words, I, you, mine, yours. Then, if we really understand this, all those words may be used less misleadingly. They are just a convenience of speech. And less violently and uncompassionately when we converse together. How often do people converse? They monologue. Look at our meals at the dining table. I've talked about this at least 3 or 4 times during all my years here. But no one pays any attention to it. Oh, it's Feroza's bee in his bonnet. It's a good bee, you know, it's a honey-making bee. Freed of the ownership of this body, I do not misuse it or torment it. Nor can I harm your body or anybody in the world. To hurt myself is to hurt you. To hurt you is to hurt myself. For now I see that there is only one body in fact. The body, and the body now is written in capitals, which is the manifested totality, all nature, the physical world. You know, those of us who have a sort of a natural fondness for nature and can appreciate it and enjoy it and do beautiful things with the things of nature, like you do with your flower arrangements and so forth, we are benefactors of the world in a real way. The body, which is the manifested totality, is in fact one body. The body, which is the manifested totality, all nature, the physical world. Physical, from physis, nature, the Greek physis, means natural. That's what it means. But ordinarily, when we say physical, we think of it as just something solid, solidity. Solid, liquid, gaseous, and all the energies which are not solid or liquid or gaseous, but are energy as such, you see, they are all part of the one whole body. Thus, body includes life, mind, consciousness. I don't think I have not come across any other work or any other speaker who has said this. When we say body, it includes life, mind, consciousness. In short, everything that I can talk about, anything of which I can make a mental construct. And by the same token, mind, spirit, life, and other such words are seen as including everything else. It's no good saying life. There is no life without the apparatus through which life manifests, the physical body, the material body, I should say. The word physical, physis, nature, means all nature. And all these things are part of nature. They are not super nature. Life, mind, consciousness, they are all part of nature. Because they come into being, have their say, and go back into the wings of the stage, the world stage. The oneness of the total reality is unbreakable. It really is. Now I can reverence and love life. With my body I thee worship. Isn't that part of the Christian marriage ceremony? With my body I thee worship. And one can say, with my body I thee love. And if those words stand for the whole reality, then it's something utterly spiritual. It is a thing of sanctity. Look at the world today. Sanctity of marriage. What's happened to it? It's a terrible tragedy. And it will bring about the destruction of those peoples who have lost their sense of the sanctity of marriage. You see, all over the world, we see that the moral backbone of people is broken. That starts the rot. It has happened with every civilization in the past which has perished. Those civilizations which have perished. It starts with affluence, first and foremost. Affluence means indulgence of the senses. Power lust, egoism, all find expression. Then comes gradually the breakdown, step by step. Things get out of hand. The powers that be cannot control them at all. And then there comes a group of people who have led a difficult life, and they are powerful, they are cruel, they are wild, and they conquer. Look at the way the Roman Empire fell. Look at the way the Greek city-states fell. The old Babylonians and the Assyrians, the Egyptians, they all fell that way. So, you see, it's important to understand this. And with my body I thee worship. And the supreme mystery, God the unknown transcendence, I can love, honor, and obey. To Caesar I can freely give my penny. I haven't got much more to give him anyway. For God I can stand in loving awe and pray that he take me wholly. And God adores the secret undeniable prayer and takes himself capital H, simple H, unto himself, capital H. You know, the Bible, is it, or wherever it is, and the manhood was taken up into the Godhead. And there's an extraordinarily profound meaning to that statement. It ties up, in my mind, with the statement in the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad. In the first chapter, section 4, it starts. In the beginning was only the Atma. Looking around and seeing no other than himself, he said, "I am." It's a pity that they use the word he. They should use the word it. Looking around and seeing no other than itself, it said, "I am." This "I am" is the equivalent of the "I am" in Exodus, chapter 3, verses 14 and 15, I think, where out of the burning bush, Yahweh Elohim speaks and answers. I mentioned this the other day, didn't I? And says to Moses, who asks him, "What shall I say to the Egyptians when they to the Israelites when they ask, 'Who has sent you?'" You see, typically Jewish. but remember, the word Israel means he who strives with God. That is not strives against God, but strives for redemption of the people with God. And that's what Yahweh Elohim says. He says, "Say unto the Israelites, Ehyeh Asher Ehyeh. I am, that is, I Moses am, that I am, the supreme one and only I am." And this ties up with this idea of the Atma, looking around, seeing none other than itself, said, "I am." You see? But of course, logically, as the sentences stand, they are utterly absurd. If there is nothing around you at all, how can you use the pronoun which differentiates you from others? You, I. You can't say it. There'd be nothing to say. Our language differentiates things very precisely. But there you are. These are the difficulties of language. But if you meditate on these things, I mean really meditate, let the brain be quiet. You see? Observe all the reactions from the brain as you try to sit still and be perfectly quiet. Then what happens is that you can truly let the mind dwell upon what you are meditating on. And in that process, that which you are meditating about loses its otherness and becomes one with your own consciousness. See, this is how the divine marriage, the marriage made in heaven in its supreme sense, takes place. The first simple meaning of marriage, the marriage made in heaven, is the unification of the two sides of your own nature in your psyche. Every one of us is male, female in his psyche or her psyche. That is the fact. Now, when those two elements, which yang and yin, you know, when they don't work in harmony, are sources of our illnesses, our miseries, and so forth. But when they are really understood by clear-sighted observation, then they become unified. That Adam and Eve is the real Adam and Eve inside every one of us, and that becomes one. You see, the name which we give Eve is actually Heva in Hebrew. Heva, you see, and oh, I've forgotten the Hebrew words for man and woman. But in Genesis, the woman comes first. The woman is mentioned first. Eve is mentioned afterwards. The woman mentioned in the beginning of Genesis is the archetypal woman and is the representative cosmically of Bina, which is the Kabbalistic name for intelligence. Intelligence which contains within itself positive and negative, masculine and feminine. This is fecundated by the mere presence of Chokhmah, which is wisdom, the wisdom of the divine. You see? And then plus minus, the positive negative within intelligence gets activated, and by this fecundation, manifestation comes into being as such. It's all a wonderful teaching, really, if one goes into it. The Buddha never touched upon such things because for his day and his people, this was quite a different tradition and something which they wouldn't understand. So now, let's go on. To Caesar I can freely give my penny. And yes, I have read that. And God adores the sweet, undeniable prayer and takes himself unto himself. This is death, the other life for me. We think of death as the end of life. Not at all. Life in its wholeness and fullness includes both birth and death. It's not a, we talk in terms of life and death. That is a mistaken, or rather, shall I say, an inadequate way of talking. Life is the immortal thing and universal thing altogether. And it includes the manifesting process of birth, death. That is those are the expressions of this ever-flowing life, this everlasting life. So I use the term life, other life. But unfortunately that term other life can be mistaken by those who believe implicitly in reincarnation and all that sort of stuff, you see, as their own entity, other life. There's no such thing. The entity as such completely goes. The I am I consciousness arises in us after birth. And how does it arise? By the parents, friends and others using the words you, I. Teaching the infant to differentiate between self and not self. It is necessary, of course. It is inevitable. We can't stop it. For the very simple reason that if we didn't do that, any person who cannot differentiate between self and a bus which is coming at 60 miles an hour at him, you see, that will certainly be the end of his I am I. You see? But we think in terms of this I am I as a permanent entity. And look at the questions the child asks. Mummy, where was I before I was born? The assumption is that there was this same I somewhere else. And where will I be after I die? You see how all these, all this conditioning spoils the purity of the mind. Pure mind cannot work then through this apparatus whose concretest expression is the brain. The brain is absolutely indispensable. And this conditioning of the brain is the thing which brings about all the necessary friction, I'll say, as well as conflict, which makes us sort of curious and inquiring and saying, what is the whole thing? What does it all mean? What is it all about? So you see, evil and what we call good are just temporary. They are relative. We live in the realm of relativity as the existential being. And we have this immense clinging to separate ego. That's the trouble. That is where the evil of the I am I self-consciousness comes in. That I am I consciousness disappears even when you're asleep. When you're soundly asleep, do you know I am I? You just don't know it. It's only in your dreams that you are very much I am I. And how very much I am I in my dreams. Good Lord. Have you noticed when you relate your dreams, it's always I, all the way. In every sentence there is an I to describe the dream. It's an extraordinary thing. But when the brain becomes sufficiently quiet and really rests in the sushupti state, you see, the dreamless slumber state, then the I am I consciousness has disappeared. How much more completely will the I am I consciousness disappear with the death of the organism, which is the root source of this mistaken I am I consciousness? Do you wonder the Buddha said vijnana is not permanent? When Sati, the fisherman's son, holds that view and that this is what carries over into a future life and so forth. The Buddha never spoke about, he spoke about future life and rebirth, and he talked about his own pubbe nivasas and so forth. But what did he actually mean by all that? You see, in those days, philosophy, science, mathematics were in a relatively primitive stage. And it is the development of mathematics, science, and not modern philosophy, principally through the development of modern mathematics and science, that we are able to see a little more clearly and deeply into these things. The knowledge of the nature of things is indispensable for attempting to understand anything which is theological or something to do with religion or transcendence in any shape or form. So, we'll go on. This is death, the other life. The transcendent taking this into itself. The manhood being lifted up into Godhead. This is death, the other life for me, whilst living in the mortal body. It can't happen after the body is dead. And the mortal body is now the temple sanctified by the ever auspicious eternal holy. I used ever auspicious there because that is the meaning of the word Shiva. Shiva means the ever auspicious. Such is the supreme meaning of the yoga of bodily discipline, which must proceed together with meditation. And such is the state of chastity.